Well, welcome to another episode of Live From My Drum Room. You might notice I'm wearing my Live From My Drum Room t-shirt, available now. I will give you information at the end of the show on how you can get your own Live From My Drum Room t-shirt. Be the envy of all the drummers you know. But first, we're going to talk to my dear friend and fabulous drummer. I'm so happy to have with me here today, the great Chad Gracie, drummer from the band Live, and as I said, I've got Chad from Live.
Here we are. What's up, everybody? Thanks for having me, John. Great to see you.
Great to see you too, buddy. Thanks for being here. Yeah, it's a good thing I didn't try to make a career out of comedy, Chad, because, you know, or drumming for that.
Believe that to the professionals, right?
That's right. Man, it's great to see you, pal. Thanks for being here.
Good to see you too, man. What last time we saw each other, 18 or 19?
19, yeah.
The tour with Bush?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I went to go and tour the factory, the Zildjian factory, when I was in Boston at that point. And I'd never been there. But shame I never got to go there when you were still there. But anyway, it's really cool experience to go see that.
That was great. I remember the night of the show, you were kind of making plans with Joe Testa and Eric Gross.
Yes.
You had a day off, and I was so glad you got to go. And I wish it could have been when I was there, but it was almost as good with those guys, I'm sure.
They were all, I mean, they were great. Joe and Eric were awesome. And, but like I said, just, you know, my father was a carpenter and stuff. So I've always been interested in building and like how things are made. So just to go see how the cymbals that I've played for years and years are made was just incredible.
That's great, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I got to say, that was such a great show. And I remember it well because 5 years ago, it was the 25th anniversary of Throwing Copper.
Right.
And you guys were on a big tour and you reached out to me and said, you know, we hadn't seen each other, been in touch, I think, since I'd left Zildjian. Maybe we'd been like through Facebook or something communicated. But it was, I just, you know, and I mean it sincerely, Chad, that when you were very genuine and saying, man, you know, I'd love for you to come out and it was a great night, and you guys sounded amazing. You sound as great as ever.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I don't know if I saw you and was like, oh man, I gotta have John out because it's been so long since I saw you. And you were one of the, you know, Zildjian was one of my first endorsers. So
yeah,
and I think it was because of you probably, but it was, you know, it's always great. Zildjian's always been great to me.
Great, man. Thank you. You know, knowing that we're going to have this conversation today and you're going to be on the show, I've been thinking about, you know, years ago when I first became aware of the band and I started this, like, do sort of a deep dive back into the music. And, you know, it's one of those records, Throwing Copper, listen to it right through. And it's,
yeah. I still go back and listen to it as well. It's still one of my favorites. That and Secret Samadhi are probably my two of my favorites from the band.
Yeah.
And yeah, like I said, I'll still listen to it myself. Yeah, we sequenced. I mean, that was back when you were making records and trying to, like, we were trying to emulate our big influences like U2 and REM and all those kind of 80s bands that we grew up with, like alternative in the 80s. And they would always have great, especially U2 would just always have amazing sequence records. Every song was freaking awesome. And you could just listen to it, you know, from start to finish. And that's what we were trying to do when we were making records.
That's great, man. But that makes perfect sense that was a very, thought out process that you guys did, you know,
It was almost painstaking to pick the sequence. And Jerry Harrison from the Talking Heads, who produced that record, was very key in putting that sequence together. When we wrote The Dam and Otter Creek, we knew that was going to start the record. And when we wrote White Discussion, we kind of figured that was going to end the record, except for the hidden track Force. But so we kind of had the front and the back. So we're putting it all in between. And then there's probably like three or four songs that are B-sides that didn't make the record that are, you know, cool songs as well.
That's cool. And, you know, I mean, just talking specifically about that record, about Throwing Copper, did you know pretty much what songs would be singles? Were there any surprises? Because the record just exploded. And I know sometimes singles become singles that weren't intended to be singles, but.
Well, it was a hell of a ride for sure. I think we knew Selling Drama was going to be the first single.
Yeah.
And then I think we were all pretty sure, including the record company, that Island was going to be the second. But we were signed to a subsidiary of MCA called Radioactive Records by a guy named Gary Kurfürst, who's a legendary manager. He started his label, Radioactive Records. And at one point, Gary Kurfürst said, "Lightning Crashes will be a single over My Dead Body." So I was like, okay. But the powers that be at MCA overruled him, or Universal, whatever it's called now. But yeah, the big wigs at MCA were like, no, that's the third single. This is going to blow the band up. I remember going to, we'd put out Selling Drama Island. We had this mixer with the record company in LA at the Universal offices. And God, I can't remember the guy's name now. Anyway, so I think it was like the VP or the president came up to, I think Patrick, Chad, and I were standing around a table. Maybe Ed was there too. And he comes up and we're just kind of talking about touring and being on the roads, how much the record is sold at this point, whatever. And he's like, yeah, by the time Lightning Crashes comes out, you guys will all be buying houses. And we were like looking at him like, okay, whatever you say. You know, we didn't believe him, but he was right. And then our booking agent at the time, Jonathan Levine, that was by around the summer of 94. He said, yeah, by next summer, you guys are going to be playing amphitheaters. You're going to be headlining. But like, really? So, yeah, it was wow. a weird, crazy time, because we started that record in clubs and then hit theaters and then did the amphitheater tour with WOMAD in 94. And that was cool, with Peter Gabriel and a bunch of world artists. And to think that, you know, the following summer we were going to be headlining those amphitheaters, we were like, you're freaking crazy.
Yeah.
And so, and we were. Arenas and amphitheaters then summer 95.
I remember, man. I remember. I first met you when you were headlining the Orpheum Theater in the fall of 94.
I was just thinking about that. I was like, yeah, I think that's the first time I met John, was at the Orpheum. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, and just, you know, and that's such a great place to see a band too. Like sonically, it's an old, you know, opera house, and you guys just, you were like an arena band already. Honestly, like you guys had it down, you know, and you know better than anybody. It's not easy to go from clubs to theaters to amphitheaters to, you know, like, and have your show kind of gel the way it does. But
yeah, well, like I said, it was cool to have the steps in between all those. In that short amount of time, in 18 months of touring, solid touring, by the time of which we were friggin' so tired, we were just like, need to go home. We headlined the Philly Spectrum, and being from Pennsylvania, that was like the penultimate, like, if you play that place, you're friggin' huge. And we headlined it, sold it out, but we were so tired. It was the last show on the tour. We were so tired. We just couldn't even relish it. It was like, need to go home.
I can imagine, man. And
but anyway, yeah, we got to take the steps and build the show into all those different venues, which was cool.
So you kind of answered one of my questions too, when you said you started it, you know, kind of started it in clubs. So, you know, that, like, working that record, did you, when you guys recorded that record, had all the material been all worked out ahead of time? Like, had you been playing some of those songs on the road already, like testing them at shows? Or
so during, we were touring for Mental Jewelry, we had written some of the songs for Throwing Copper, but not all of them. And so we were playing some of the things. I can't even remember what songs we had during Mental Jewelry that we were playing, but yeah, that was what we did back in those days. We would write songs and then go out and play them live, because, you know, when you play something live, you have a whole different energy than just recording it or writing it.
Yeah.
You know, it just gives it a different spark. And then you may do a little, something a little different in the verse or the bridge or whatever. And then you're like, oh, that's a great idea, we should put that down. This is the things you discover when you're playing the songs live. So we would always go out and do that and hone them down. And then, you know, we did extensive pre-production for Throwing Copper with Jerry in Milwaukee. And funny story about that. So we recorded Mental Jewelry with Jerry in Milwaukee as well. And we did pre-production for that record in this little sound studio with this hippie dude. I can't remember his name, but like, the whole place was covered in carpet. It was probably about 1,000 square foot like studio or whatever. And so we're taking the songs from Enter Jewelry in there. We're playing them and the guy was digging it, whatever. And so, obviously we made the record with Jerry and then came back to that same place with the song for Throwing Copper. And now it's like Chad had big amps and like super distorted and we were super loud. And so now we're in his space again and we're freaking jamming out all these songs. And he comes out and he's like, man, guys, you listen, the songs are cool, but like the vibe you had with Mental Jewelry and like this, you're just too loud now, man. And we're like, okay. We're like, sorry, dude. And then we ended up recording that record at Pachyderm Studios out in Cannon Falls, Minnesota, where previously Nirvana had recorded In Utero.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know if that studio is still around, but it was a cool studio out in the woods in Minnesota. Yeah.
Wow. That's a great story, man. Yeah. It's funny how, just everybody evolves,
yeah.
So talking about you, I mean, from the first note I heard you play, I swear this too, like, and I've told you this, I think I'm a huge fan of your drumming, first of all, and I've been for a long time. And all you guys were so young when you'd been making records. You had this Throwing Copper was your third record, I think, right?
Technically, our first record was called, but we were under a different name, Public Affection, but Death of the Dictionary.
Yeah. Okay. So, this was obviously the big breakthrough. And, but you were like 22 when you recorded it, I think, right? Does that sound about right?
Probably 22 or 23. I think it came out when we were 24. It came out in 94. So I would have been 23. So 22, when we recorded. Yeah, you're right. Correct.
Yeah. I mean, just like the playing was so mature for young musicians, and it was obvious you guys had been playing together a long time since like high school, right? I mean, basically. More or less.
We started the band in eighth grade with Patrick, Chad, and I, and then Ed joined the summer between eighth grade and ninth grade. So all through high school, we were the foursome honing our playing. And we were doing covers mostly for like ninth, 10th, 11th grade. We started writing originals.
So by the time, basically you graduated high school, 17, 18 years old, and had you guys become like an original, pretty much an original band at that point?
Yeah, our senior year is when we recorded the Death of a Dictionary, and we raised $12,000 from friends and family to make that record, because we had hired a manager, this guy named David Sestek out of Easton, Pennsylvania, and he was our manager, and he was like, listen, guys, I'm your manager, but you don't have anything for me to shop to record labels, so you got to make a record. So that's how we raised the money. Death of a Dictionary during our 12th grade year.
Wow.
We made it in like 3 days over a weekend. And so he started shopping that. We graduated that June, and applied to colleges. We were all accepted to different colleges and stuff, but we told our parents we're deferring for a year to do music.
So
we graduated and we started playing, driving to New York City and playing at CBGBs. And that's where we got signed out of. We did a lot of playing, mostly in my garage, and just honed our skills behind the scenes. Got the cops called on us a lot.
Yeah. But you probably built a massive following. I got to think that, that's how you do it, man. That's that grassroots, like, probably were playing like 200 gigs a year, I'm guessing, in those days.
In our high school days, no, not that many, but
not that many.
Once we graduated, we were just playing wherever we could. Mostly a lot of our playing was done at a place called the Comedian Club in Lancaster. Mm-hmm. And this guy named Rich Ruhoff owned that place, and he was a big advocate of the band, so he'd have us back all the time. We opened for the Pixies there in 89, which was totally cool for us because we're big Pixies fans.
Yeah.
And so we just play wherever we could.
So when did you start playing drums, Chad? How old were you?
I was 12 when I started playing drums. I had always been interested in drums when I was growing up and younger. And I would drive my parents crazy, tap them on the back of their seats to, in the car. And then when I was 12, this kid in the neighborhood, named Dave Wentz, who lived kind of down behind my house. He had a yard sale, and I went to the yard sale, and he had this drum set there, which I still have. It's called a Ruther drum set.
Oh yeah,
I don't think. Yeah, have you heard of them? Yeah,
so. Yeah, they're made by Pearl, I think. It's a what they call a made like what do they call it? Private, not a private label. Yeah,
it's like a white label.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so he had this set there for $150, and it was like, you know, a five piece with, you know, really like basic stands, and I think he had a couple cymbals and some hi-hats. So I was like, wow, so I went to my mom, I'm like, listen, I want to buy this drum set. She's like, well, you know, how are you going to get the money? I was like, well, I have savings bonds from grandma and grandpa. She's like, okay, well, if you want to cash some of those in, that's fine. So I cashed in $150 of savings bonds and went and bought the set from Dave and set it up. We were living in a three-story like townhouse in York. My brother, oddly enough, lives right up the street from where we grew up. So they put me on the third floor and I was up there, you know, day and night, just pounding away. And it was actually a semi attached house. So we had shared a wall with our neighbors, the Landises, and they were like, what the fuck is this kid doing up there? Driving them crazy, driving my parents crazy. And I was just playing I started playing the Beatles records first, which is because I figured like, I was like, you know, Ringo and all his basicness is amazing what he does, obviously. But it's, you know, it's easy to learn. And except for, you know, his left-handed, the way he starts fills, you're like,
yeah, I know.
Wait a minute, how am I going to do that? Anyways, but I could figure out the basic beats. I would just kind of figure out what the hi-hat was doing, the snare doing, the kick drum, and just start to learn from there. And then my biggest influence is probably Larry Mullins from U2. Because I was just a big U2 fan at that, you know, especially in my high school years.
Yeah. Yeah, you would have been, so by my estimation, like when you started playing drums, it was around 1983-ish, 84, something like that?
Yeah, 84, 85, yeah, somewhere around 85, yeah.
I wondered, too, just like I'd made some notes because like later on, like as you developed and grew and like by the time 1994 came around and you're recording like Throwing Copper, for example, some of your playing on some of those songs, it's like has this linear approach to it. And I wondered if like Stuart Copeland was, if you know, if that was, I mean, even like Dave Weckl and Vinnie Colaiuta, I hear like some of that linear stuff.
Well, so when you say linear, you mean like, what do you mean?
Well, like a hi-hat, you're playing the bellow of the ride cymbal, and then you're doing like a hi-hat thing with your other hand, like you're right-handed, so you'd be, like
right. Yeah.
So yeah, and it, you know, it fits perfectly with the songs that you're doing, and you know, that's it's like a linear thing that you hear guys like Vinny and Dave Weckl and
a lot of those choices were just like me trying to figure out something different to do in the songs instead of just hi-hat snare all the time or hi-hat ride or ride snare kick all the time. So I was just trying out different stuff. And that's kind of how I came up with the maraca thing and Pain Lies on Riverside and Mental Jewelry. Yeah. There was this maraca laying around. We were kicking around this idea, and I just started going, you know, it's like, wow, that's cool. Let's do that. You know, so a lot of it was just experimentation. And then Jerry kind of would do this in the songs, but Jerry was really instrumental in teaching me kind of to be like kind of build the song, build the drum part through the song instead of starting all busy, start very simple. Yep. Get busier towards the end. So, yeah.
That's, I'm so glad you said that. I had made a note to talk about Lightning Crashes, for example, you know, like how that song builds. It's just like what you said, a great example of just, and, you know, I can't help but say and think, Chad, that like you sound like such a, you know, like a mature is maybe even not the right word for it, but like, somebody who's been playing a lot longer than you'd been playing at that time, you know, and at a level of like real seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, like what the song was going to be. And like you say, building it, and it's really masterful.
Wow. I appreciate that. Yeah. Yeah. Lightning Crash was interesting because when we wrote that song, we all started at the same time, just like we did the intro all together, like bass and drums and guitar. And it was Jerry in pre-production who said, why don't you guys hang out for a little bit, like the bass and drums, and you guys come in after like maybe the first verse or something. We're like, okay, that sounds cool. That's how that song was made. But as far, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's, I just, what it, I was very passionate about the drumming. I wanted to do things that were sort of different, but that fit the song. And I mean, I guess that was a, my ticket to being a mature player. I don't know.
Yeah, no, really. I mean it. It's, I think everything that you play like fits perfectly. There's no busyness. There's no, even when I've seen you live, you know, all, you know, number of times now. And, you know, I think it's natural, I think, for to have a tendency to maybe get a little busier when you're live, you know, but you.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, I mean, I think also it was because like when we were growing up in York and we had our band and we were playing covers, we couldn't really find anywhere to play because it was all hair metal. It was huge there. And I was, so we were kind of anti-hair metal because just, more because like we were into like U2 and REM and INXS because of Patrick's older brother kind of got us into all those bands and hair metal. So listening to the hair metal and all the, you know, the, they were, the drummers were like really generally really busy and like crazy fills and drum solos. And I was like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be like that.
Yeah.
So that was like my, I guess my style developed from, being anti-hair metal.
Yeah. No. And the fact that Larry Mullen is such an influence explains a lot, you know, and I honestly didn't put that together, but that makes perfect sense. And that I think of Larry, I think he's a phenomenal drummer. And I think he's one of these guys that doesn't get the credit for like playing the perfect part for the song and never, you know, it's like, I won't say he's busy, but he can be busier when he needs to be busier. But, but it's like he's playing for the integrity of like, making a great song like my buddy Charlie Watts, you know, and like Ringo and
absolutely.
And that's what our job really is. It's not, you know, despite what some drummers might think, it's not to, you know.
Yeah. I still to this day, I don't like show off drummers. It's just not my thing. And you know, it's cool. That's what they do. Great.
Yeah.
The stick twirling and all that crap. I'm just like, nope, I'm back here. I always kind of likened it. I grew up my father was a carpenter growing up, so I grew up in a blue-collar family. That's kind of how, like, in a weird way, I describe my drummers. Like, my drumming is, like, blue-collar. Like, it's basic, but it gets the job done, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I get it. I do, I get it. But I think you're kind of being humble, a little too humble in saying that it's basic because there's a lot of there's a lot of thought and ideas that goes in, that go into it. You know what I mean? You're not just
Yes. It was there. Yeah, all the parts are pretty well thought out, and I choose fills specifically and specific spots for color, and not and try to, and then wouldn't try to play over the lyrics. Or I was always cognizant of the melody and the lyrics.
Yeah,
and what it was, you know, what I was doing. So. Yeah,
that's stuff that a lot of people don't figure out until they're much older, you know, and that's, mm-hmm. that's what I should have said that at the beginning, but that's what impressed me so much is that, and all you guys, you know, like we're really, playing for the integrity of the song as young. I mean, I remember, you know, I sound like the old guy, but when I was your age, no, when I was in my early 20s, you know, I was like, hey, there's four bars for me to go fill, you know, take a
right.
four, you know, open space. I'm going to fill it right now. But,
the four of us are like magic in a bottle. It's like, you know, there's when we were together, we were writing together. It was just, I don't know. We were all trying to be respectful of each other's parts, but also do our thing in the song.
Yeah.
You know, and then I think that's how it developed. And we were all cognizant of space because of bands like REM and U2. Like you listen to them. It's not, you know, like Bill Berry wasn't going the fuck off all the time, and
no,
Larry
no.
Mullins wasn't going off, but when he needed to, he did. You know, both of those drummers, when it was time to like go crazy, they would.
Exactly, and I'm glad you mentioned Bill Berry because maybe the most underrated drummer in the world. I mean,
oh yeah.
What an incredible.
In 19, we covered Losing My Religion and just, I really had to sit down and like, I'd listened to that song many times, but I never sat down and learned the part. And I was like, oh, wow, this is cool. Like, he's doing a lot of these snare and tom hits at the same time and stuff like that.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. Those are cool. Cool to sit down and learn that song and go, oh, yeah, appreciate Bill Berry.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Real hum. I don't know him well, but he was one of the first guys that I signed when I went to work for Zildjian in 89. He was playing Meinl cymbals back then.
And, okay.
Before they were really a known company. And anyway, I at Great Woods where I saw you, I met him in 1989 and a real humble, you know, quiet guy. And
I never got to meet him. I never got to meet Larry either. Got to meet Michael Stipe and hang out with him a couple times, but never Bill. And then I met Bono, The Edge, and Adam, but never Larry.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I never met Larry. Yeah. Well.
The funny story about Larry is that I have a old business partner named Brian, who is actually in business with Jerry Harrison. And they were having a dinner in New York with Larry Mullen somehow.
Wow.
And we famously are one of the only bands that turned down U2, or infamously, I guess, I don't know what, but we turned down U2 to open for them in like 94 because we were embarking on a theater tour. We're like, we wanted to establish ourselves as a headlining band. But Larry, I guess, was always in charge of picking the opening acts, and he got rarely told no. So they had this dinner with him in like 2000, I think, for 21 or 22 in New York. And Brian and Jerry, I think, I don't know if they were talking about live or whatever, but Larry was like, oh, yeah, they turned us down to open. He still remembers it. I was like, oh, my God. So if I ever do meet him, I'm going to have to, like, bow down and apologize. Sorry, yeah. Sir.
It wasn't my decision. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, that's
I can't believe you're still talking about it.
He's pissed, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to think he respects the decision you made, man. It was the right one because that's what you needed to do at that time, man. You had the product to get out there and do what you did. So,
yeah, it would have been fun, really cool to do. But you know, like I said, we were on our own path. So,
Yeah. Chad, do you remember when I met you in 94? I think you had just signed with Pearl Drums, and I know you're with DW now, but. Did you record with DW Drums? Like, did you like have a DW set and then you got a Pearl endorsement? I know this is like a crazy.
No, I had the Ruther, and then the first set I bought was Pearl.
It was
I bought
okay.
my own set. Yeah, I bought an export set. And so I used those Ruthers. Recorded. I think I recorded Death of the Dictionary on the Ruthers, but then I got between. That and Mental Jewelry, we got an advance, and so for Mental Jewelry, and I went out and bought Pearl set.
Yeah.
And I've been okay. Pearl ever since then. I got endorsed, I think, 93, 94, you're probably right, but somewhere around there.
Yeah. Okay, yep. I feel like you had just, because I think we signed you up around 93 or 94 mm-hmm. at Zildjian, and I think the Pearl thing, I think, like was right after that or something, but... or around that time. But so did you record, so you recorded on your own drums, Throwing Copper? Was that was your personal kit or was it like a studio kit? Do you remember?
No, Throwing Copper, I had a green set that I got, before Throwing Copper, I believe. Let me think here. It's hard to remember. I bought an export set and then I think I recorded Throwing Copper with Pearl Export. There's a black kit that I had.
Wow.
And then amazing. I got that green kit when I started touring for Throwing Copper.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I believe. It's hard to remember back exactly, but I think that's what happened.
I know. I know. I'm testing your memory 30 years because the drum sound on that record is incredible. It's such a great sounding.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think it's the studio, the engineer, and then of course, Tom Lodalgi mixed. You know, all Throwing Copper, and he blew that out of the park.
Yeah.
Because he's an amazing mixer. It's funny, we mixed that record in an old Playboy hotel in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And it was closed down, but they had this studio in an outbuilding. And so we had access to the inside of this abandoned hotel. So we're you know, Tom Lodowski's in there mixing away, and we would come in and listen to mixes once in a while, but otherwise we were just hanging out. So we were running around this freaking hotel, abandoned hotel, just going in the room. I don't know. It was fucking funny, but anyway, it was
that's what kids do.
Good time. But yeah. I would mean, Tom definitely made all the drums punch for sure. That's what he does. So
yeah. Yeah. I'm going to play a song in a second. And, cool. Yeah, I was going to ask, and the cymbals were probably a zildjians. It sounds like.
Yes. Part
back
oh
then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had, yeah, we used 13 inch, quick beat, hi-hats back in those days. Right. I've gotten more, lately I've been using K's. I've been going a little darker with all my cymbals, but yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing that when I mentioned Stuart Copeland earlier, and this is kind of like a cheesy
I was going to say Stuart was probably an influence by osmosis because I did listen to The Police, but I wasn't like a student of him, but I mean, respect him immensely, obviously, and was a Police fan, but sure. So go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's okay, Chad. No, I was going to say it might be Lightning Crashes where there's a couple of little spots where you're hitting a splash cymbal or it sounds like a very small crash. Mm. I was listening this morning. Well, I'm gonna play All Over You right now.
Cool.
Yeah, and we'll just everybody can listen at home. This is from Throwing Copper, the great Chad Gracie on drums.
Oh,
Man,
always cool to listen to.
Pretty badass, buddy. Pretty damn badass. That's
thank you.
Yeah.
Did you say before it started? Did you say that was the first single off the record?
Was it the first single of the record?
No, it was. No. So, Selling Drama was the first single.
Yeah.
Actually, All Over You came out after Lightning Crashes, and it was kind of spontaneously played by a bunch of different radio stations. We didn't actually put it out as a single. It was not an official release as a single, but it just. Like after the hugest of Lightning Crashes, somehow spontaneously all these radio stations started playing All Over You. Canada. De facto like, hit, I guess.
Like at the end of 94 probably, right? Like
95.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, man, the just the dynamics in that song, like the, you know, just again, all the choices, the way you just build the parts to those to these songs is just masterful. It really is. Oh,
thank you.
Yeah, man. Yeah, and
it's nice to be appreciated. I love it. Thanks, man.
You got it, man. Yeah, of course. I know you're a humble guy. I remember the first time meeting you and telling you like, oh man, I love the way you play, and you're very like, thanks. Like, you know, I didn't, but I meant it sincerely that it was.
Oh, I appreciate it. I do. I'm a little shy and reserved. So yes, and humble, I guess you would say. So yeah, it's yeah, but yeah, I appreciate it.
Nothing wrong with that, pal. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah, let's play some more music. I'm just looking at some comments here and lots of folks watching. And Chris Freeman said the Silver Sparkle came in the Secret Tour. And was
right. Chris Freeman was my drum tech for a while. So
that's what I thought. Yeah, that's right. Hey, Chris.
Chris.
Good to see you, brother. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Glad he was there to give us the info.
Yeah, the Silver Sparkles are somewhere in London in a storage place. I'm trying to get them back. we sent them over there because we were going to Europe so much, and we just stored them at this place in London, and John Henry, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And they're still there. So I had a buddy trying to get them back, but I don't know what's going on with them.
Wow. Okay. Well, I used to do a lot of work with those guys when I was with Zildjian, and I could – offline, give you the. I have John Henry's personal information, the owner.
Oh, cool! Yeah, try him out. My friend, he's a truck driver. He also does some tour logistics, and he was trying to get them onto someone's carne to get them back here.
Yeah,
you know how the carne thing goes with the international shipping.
It's ass. It's a big pain in the ass. Yeah, it's like, you know, you got to write down to the ounce of
right.
Millimeter of the size and the weight and the all right, well I'm happy. When we finish, I'll send you.
Cool, that'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm gonna play Selling the Drama, another just masterful bit of playing by you and the band.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Love for God, into fear of flame. And to burn a crowd that has a name, and to right or wrong, and to meek or strong, it is known to scream from the wall. I will, I want, I will, I taught, I know, I've been every boy. Now we'll all be ready.
share. I will sit and earn the ransom from a peer. I will, I want, I've read, I've taught, I know, I've been every boy. Now it won't be raped. Hey, now it won't be scarred like that. Hey, now it won't be raped. Hey, now it won't be scarred like that. Scarred like that. Yeah, 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 yeah. And to love a god, and to fear a flame, and to burn a love that has a name. I will, I want, I've read, I've taught, I know, I've been every boy. Now it won't be raped, hey, now it won't be scarred like that, hey, now it won't be raped, hey.
Man. So Chad, did you record those with the click track?
No, we didn't record anything with the click track until the record 5.
No kidding.
Yeah. We recorded that in 2000-ish. We recorded 5, but that's the first time we used a click track, to record. And, that was mostly because, Ed started kind of writing all the songs sort of on his own and sort of presenting them to us. We weren't getting in the room anymore. Mm. And so he was just recording them to a click track, and I come in and play the drums to him. But yeah, no click tracks until then. I just heard Danny Carey talking about this. You know, the Tool records have never been recorded to a click track. I don't know how the fuck you would have a click track, on a Tool record anyway.
I was going to say, that doesn't surprise me, but you surprised me because your time is ridiculous. And I, you know, assumed that, just, you know, I mean, that's even in 1994, it was a pretty common thing for tools, pre-pro tools. So
yeah, we were anti-click track. We didn't want to do it. We were like, F that. That's for, you know, that's not for real musicians.
Yeah, man, whatever. That takes you up like 10 more notches. I'm sorry, but it really does.
Thank
you.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think I had always had pretty good natural timing. Like, just like I said, when I was coming up, being interested in drums, not having a drum set yet, I had good timing playing along to the radio.
Yeah. So. And your influences, I think this has a lot to do with it too. You know, I would say that, you know, it sounds like Bill Berry and Larry Mullen Jr. were like some of your bigger influences. And when you have guys like that you listen to, and they have, both of those guys have excellent rock solid time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I can't help but think that sort of instills it into your ability to, you know, to play in well in time, you know?
I would think so. Yeah. That makes sense. And, another big influence was like Tony Thompson.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
He played on, so there was a Duran Duran record, I think, that came out where Andy Taylor was not on the drums anymore. No, not Andy Taylor. John Taylor. What the hell's the drummer's
name? I think Roger it was Taylor. Roger Taylor. Yeah. The other
Roger Taylor didn't play on this record. I believe it was Tony Thompson. It was like, it was Notorious was on that record, that song Notorious.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that came out right around when I was playing in my room a lot. So I played to that a lot too. So anyway.
Yeah. I remember it was like 85, 86, probably around that time, maybe, when he had the band, The Power Station too.
Yes. And we covered a bunch of those songs too.
Yeah.
So yeah, again, Tony Thompson, right?
Yeah. I knew Tony. He was a sweetheart, man. You know, rest in peace. He's a phenomenal guy.
They're all leaving us. Friggin' Neil and Tony Thompson.
That was one of the first things I had actually meant to ask you, and I kind of assumed the answer was yes, that there was a click track there, because the time is so great. It's so spot on.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, that, like I said, that wasn't just me. That was the whole band. We're like, we're not doing click track.
Yeah. No, it's and you, it's obviously you and Patrick, I mean, have a real natural, the way you guys lock in,
It's, yeah, we were always locked. It was, it's just a natural thing that happened.
Yeah. And I think that comes with, childhood friends playing together for a lot of years. And I would bet you that, I don't know, I don't want to assume anything, but it's probably not the same for him when he plays with another drummer and when you play with another bass player. It's maybe not like you know what I mean? It's like you play with somebody that long and it's like a pair of old shoes. You put them back on and they feel great.
Yeah. For sure. And they know where you're going to go and you kind of, you just gel together. Yeah. It's definitely different to play with different bass players.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. Well, I'm going to play one more song.
Cool.
And I was going to ask you before I play this song, but I was going to play, I'm going to play, no surprise, Lightning Crashes. And such a great, great song, man. Such a masterful job that you did and the whole band did. And, this kind of crossed my mind. Are you playing hot rods like those?
Yes.
You are? Okay.
Yes. I just recorded that and put out that song on my YouTube channel. I have a YouTube channel, Chad Gracie, at Chad Gracie Live.
Okay.
Well, I'm in the process of recording all the songs. So I've recorded all the big hits so far. And the last one I put out was Lightning Crashes. So, if you want, people can go and watch exactly what I do. It's a 3-camera shoot.
Fantastic.
On YouTube channel.
I will put
really
the link.
Cool.
Yeah. I'll make sure the link is in the description. And also, I don't want to forget to talk about your podcast, which we'll do after we play this song. Yeah, let's talk about that. But, okay, Chad, how did I not really ever sort of realize that all these years of hearing it? It occurred to me. It's like when you're playing it sounds like it when you're playing the snare, but definitely when you're playing the tom-tom, riding probably the floor tom.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it was just, it was a choice I made because the song was kind of quiet and I was like, try hot rods on this.
Yeah. So when you start with the cross stick part, is that a hot rod too? Or is that a regular stick when you first come in around a minute or so in and you're.
I'm not doing cross stick. I'm just lightly hitting the snare with a hot rod.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Man. All right. Well, this makes it even more thrilling if you ask me.
Cool.
All right. Check it out, everybody. Here it comes.
This is a song where I rest during the show. Long intro.
Yeah.
Belongs now to the beat. baby down the hall. Oh, my feeling coming back again, like a rolling thunder chasing the wind. Forces pulling from the center of the earth again. I can feel it. Lightning crashes, oh mother cries. This moment she's been waiting for.
Chad, man.
Yeah, it's cool to be, you know, part of a, something that's like a song that became that big. It's like, you know, really cool to listen to it and even just understand like how many people it's touched and how many people have listened to it. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well said, buddy. Well said. It's great that you can see it that way too, because that you know that that's touched so many people.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm sure there are couples that got married and that was their theme, you know. It's
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Man, so great, so great, so inspiring, really, as a drummer. I just love your choices and I love, you know, what you play, what you leave out, you know, knowing what to play all the time and your sounds. And someone had asked, sorry, I don't mean to keep rambling here, but Heidi had asked, Heidi's somebody who watches my show all the time and I appreciate it. And she had asked what hot rods are. And this is the Vic Firth version of them. Mm-hmm. And you use the ProMark ones.
Yeah.
So there are these.
What does Vic Firth call them?
They call them Talon. I think they call them, this is a Steve Smith Talon wand or something like that.
Okay, cool. Nice.
Yeah, for a long time, Promark had the patent on these, so every company, that made these had to pay them a royalty. But that's expired. Yeah.
I put tape on the up towards the top of the end there, so they don't break apart so fast.
Right, so, right. Chris Freeman said that. I know, because I could imagine you splitting these pretty quick. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I'd shred the shit out of them. And there's all these. And I played barefoot. I don't know if you know that, but I learned how to play drums in my room without putting shoes on. So I've always played barefoot. So you split those things up, and they make nasty splinters. Which fortunately, I've never gotten in my foot. So
good. I didn't realize that you played barefoot. Yeah, that's you don't want to be stepping on little shreds of that.
No, definitely not.
No. I want to talk about your podcast too.
No, The Gracious Two.
The Gracious Two.
Chad Patrick and I did a side band with Kevin Martin from Candlebox. And we called it The Gracious Few.
Yes, yeah.
And so that's kind of where we got the name.
Yeah, that's great, man. Yeah. And I'll put the link for that and you do it's a weekly podcast, right?
Yeah, we do it every Tuesday live at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Every Tuesday. We're on I think we're at show we just did show 33.
That's great. That's great.
We kind of start out the show. I wouldn't say we get necessarily political. We just kind of point out some of the propaganda bullshit that's going on in this world sometimes. But then we usually have on like a live fan, like a super live fan I find on Facebook or Instagram. And I was like, hey, come on the show and talk about your experience with the band, how you got into us, what shows you were at, all that stuff. And so that's always cool. And then lately we've been starting to get, you know, I guess I'm quote unquote famous people, but we just had on the actress that played Pippi Longstocking in the movie as a child. Her name's Tammy Aaron. So she was just on. And a couple months ago we had Larry Hankin you know his name. Well, a lot of people don't know his name, but they know his face. So he was most famously the cop in Home Alone. That's on the phone with Kevin at the station.
Yes.
So anyway. So we're branching out and just trying to keep it fresh and do different things, but we still have having the live fans on occasionally from all over the world. We just had a guy from South Africa on, looking for some Australians to come on, you know, so just talk about the band and have a good time.
That's great, man. What a great idea. What a great concept too. I'm sure there's no shortage of fans that want to come on and, you know, share their stories and just hang with you guys, right? Who wouldn't want to?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And they can ask me questions like about the band that I've always wanted to know. I'll try to answer them. Don't ask me lyric questions. I don't know.
Is it live on Facebook or Instagram or YouTube or?
We go live on Facebook. We go live on Rumble. We go live. We were going live on YouTube, but we've gotten some strikes for talking about stuff. So now we kind of put up shorts and stuff on YouTube. So so it's live on Facebook. And we were doing live on Instagram, but Instagram's weird to go live on because you have to be if you're doing it through Zoom, the way the camera's set up on Instagram, like you only can see like half the screen. It's kind of weird. So we stopped doing that.
Yeah. Cause it's vertical or something. Is that why? I've never done my thing on Instagram because it just seemed very limited and we're on Facebook now
We've been kind of doing like an auxiliary show, if you will, on Instagram live, like once a week, we'll go on like at 8:30 in the evening and just bullshit. Just the two of us on, you know, we'll get on Instagram and go through it that way. So that works out better. But anyway, it's on all major platforms, Spotify, Apple, all Apple Podcasts, Rumble,
that's great.
YouTube, Facebook.
Awesome. I'll put all the links for all that stuff in the description when I put this up on YouTube. And I want to just one last thing I want to do is share a photo that I knew I had and I had to look for it this morning. All right. This was a photo that I took of you and my daughter in 1995 at Great Woods. I think I might have even sent you a copy a long, long time ago, but
yeah.
My daughter is 34 now. She'll be 35 in September. But
boy,
I took both.
So what, she was 4 or 5 then?
Yeah. Yeah. She was like, she was, I think, 5 years old. Yeah. And 5 or 6. And I took my son's 2 years older and I took them both. But for whatever reason, I'm not just making this up. And she was never like this, my little sweet daughter. But she had a crush on you. She said, yeah, she never, I took her to see so many bands when they were little. I was divorced, so I had my kids on the weekend. So I'd, you know, if a band came through town on the weekend, I'd take my kids with me. And she never was, she was always pretty shy around, I'd say, say hello to, you know, Steve Gorman of the Black Crows. And she'd say, hi, Steve, you know, but she, I feel like she jumped in your arms when I took this picture.
Oh my. Well, kids, anyway. Kids always seem to like me, so I guess that's it. But that's so cool. I love it.
Yeah, it is. It's just, I showed it to my wife this morning. She went, oh my God, look at that picture. So it's, and it's a great picture of you too. It's
absolutely. Not, wow. Yeah. So young.
I know, man. Well, you haven't changed much, really. I mean, you know.
Well, I was, I take a ton of supplements every day. So I've been taking them for years and years and years. I take all kinds of stuff, try to ward off the aging process, but you know,
that's good. Smart man. Yeah. Anyway, well, I thank you so much for being here today. It's been so
my pleasure. Thank you for asking me, Matt. And we'll have to have you on the Gracious Two as well.
I'd
be a very interesting guest. Be fun.
Thanks, man. Thank you. It's you got plenty of interesting guests, it sounds like, though. So, but
well,
thank you.
I mean, Ed, you as one of my very first endorsers, or, you know, well, Zildjian, but you were there and basically signed me. It was, you know, it would be a pleasure to have you on talk about
that.
Thank you, Chad.
Thanks, buddy. All right. Well, hang with me if you would 1 minute, and I'll end the live stream. But I want to thank everybody for watching today, and please give a big hand for Chad Gracie.
Thanks, everybody. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for watching, everybody, and we'll see y'all real soon. Hey, everybody, John DeChristopher here, and I want to thank you for watching and listening to Live from My Drum Room. I started this show in April of 2020, and it's now 4 years and almost 200 episodes later, and I'm excited to tell you about my new Live from My Drum Room t-shirts. In fact, I'm wearing one right now. Made of 60% cotton, 40% polyester, a really soft cotton blend. Doesn't shrink really at all, or hardly at all. True to size, I'm wearing a size medium. And you can have yours for $25, including shipping, in the contiguous U.S. I will give you my Venmo information, which I'll also include in the description. There's my Venmo information. And you can email me at livefrommydrumroom@gmail.com with any questions, and that will also be in the description. So get your shirt while they last. They're available in extra small to double XL. I do have limited quantities of the extra smalls and the double XLs, but plenty of everything else. So once again, thanks for watching, thanks for listening, thanks for subscribing, and don't forget to pick up your Live from My Drum Room t-shirt. See you soon. And remember, no drummers are harmed on any show. All right, well, that's my show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, give it a like, leave me a comment. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel if you haven't done that already. And the podcast is available on all the podcast platforms, so download it. And remember, no drummers are ever harmed on Live from My Drum Room or Track Talk. And drummers, when in doubt, leave it out. All right, again, thanks for watching, thanks for listening, and I'll see you again real soon. See ya.